Emeritus in English at the University here at ULL, and he served as the director of the Creative Writing and Interdisciplinary Humanities Program. He was appointed Louisiana Poet Laureate by then-Governor Kathleen Blanco in 2007 and was reappointed then by Governor Bobby Jindal in 2009. Prior to his current book, which we're going to talk about today, his poetry collections include Call and Response and In Ordinary Light, New and Selective Poems. He's also right here on KRVS, the host of the Poets Corner on Thursday afternoon. So, welcome, Daryl.
Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here today. I want to go back before we get into talking about your new book, but I am going to read. I found a wonderful interview with you online, and it was on actually NOLA.com. But I want to read a quote, and then I want to talk to you about some things you said in there. Coming from a family of farmers, my response to the garden is a farmer's legacy. I began to realize that the geography of the garden represents something that's closely akin to what I know about art. In lots of ways, I think if you see my garden, you understand my poems better. I've learned more about line and stanza from actually working the garden than I have from reading about line and stanza in books. Do you remember that quote?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do.
And what I'm curious about that last part. What is it about gardening, or what is it about your garden that has taught you about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, the word stanza means room.
It means room?
Room.
Oh,
yes.
I didn't know. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so gardens are made up of these lines, you know, lines of okra, and lines of you know, in the larger form. I grew up when St. Landry Parish's products were mostly corn and sweet potato and cotton, and those are all relatively low-growing plants. So you sort of get – and even with higher plants like sugarcane, you get a sense of the line, you know, that constitutes this repetition of lines that constitutes a plot in a form or a plot in a garden.
Yeah.
And my garden that I have on the little piece of land that I live on in South St. Landry Parish is divided into little rooms, you know, little compartments. And so I've made a kind of outdoor house, which is an extension of the little bungalow, you know, that I live in. And so
I've never heard anybody describe it that way with gardening.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And so, you know, there are these distinct parts of the yard, or which is what we call a garden.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, figuring out, you know, whether the line was going to be curved or whether the line was going to be straight in the garden taught me a great deal when I came to the poem, you know, because there's a kind of straightforward instop line, you know, that's sort of like the rows in a cotton field. You know, they're all the same.
Yeah.
And the danger there in a poem is that the poem has a tendency to be predictable and sort of sing-song.
Yeah.
And so when you go into the line in a poem, you have to find something to sort of work counter to that idea of being too predictable.
Yeah.
And so you do these kinds of little wavy things in the middle of a line, you know, perhaps with phrases and syntax, you know, that that makes the line more textured and more interesting. And you do the same thing with rhyme in the stanzas or the rooms that constitute a poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm curious, when is gardening inspirational for you in terms of your writing?
Oh yeah.
You know what? Do you keep a pad or a recorder? Like if you're out working in the garden, is that a time where ideas come?
No. They're two very distinct activities for me.
Huh.
Because being in the garden takes everything.
Okay.
You know, it's a total you know, emotional, physical psychological engagement for me. I'm reminded one time somebody asked Georgia O'Keeffe if she listened to music when she painted, and she said no, both activities take too much intellectual and emotional energy.
Sure.
And that it's the same way. You know, I know that the gardening influences the poetry, and I know that the poetry influences the garden, but when I'm in either one of those activities. I'm in it, and it's a solitary
activity. Oh, that's interesting.
Activity. Yes.
So I'm curious with you, because I really haven't gotten a chance to talk to you about this before, but how do the words come to you? How does a piece come to you?
Well,
is it different?
It is different. I mean, I think they are two things that I can say has a lot to do with the ways in which my poems are generated. One is working in workshops, and that's the kind of teaching that I continue to do, and I do lots of work with young people until fairly recently. And so, you know, at least nearly one half of my poems come from projects or poems that I start inside of workshops working with young people.
Okay, so let me ask you a question, because something just clicked for me. And this is, I think, was in the same interview that I had read that you had done, that you had talked about during the period, the majority while you were teaching, you were not writing poetry.
Right.
And so I'm curious if – you know what was? I wonder if that was about, because when you're in it, you're in it. Whatever it is you're doing,
right?
Was that a part of that? Do you think?
I think it definitely was a part of it because the whole time that I was a teacher as a professional activity, that was my priority. I mean, I considered myself a teacher first, and then the poems were occasional poems and came to me sort of sporadically. And I think it does have something to do with, you know, that kind of focus and concentration on what you're doing. Teaching requires, such a huge amount of energy and focus that often often you really have to change gears, to write the kind of critical academic articles. You know, you have to pull away from the teaching energy and shift over to that other kind of energy. And then another big shift is the shift to doing creative work.
Yeah.
But getting back to the question that you were asking, the other thing that I think creates so many of the poems for me is walking, and every morning I walk the road near my house, and it's sort of a straight shot. I walk from one stop sign to the next, which is a mile and a half, and then turn around and walk back. And often if during that walk I can get the first line of a poem, and very often when I begin the walk I have an idea for a poem, but I don't have the first line.
So do you have something that – or do you remember it, or do you – do you have a recorder?
No. I don't use a recorder. I usually remember it, and it's relatively.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That happens for you that way.
Yeah, and it's relatively easy to remember because I'm always, particularly in the first line of a poem, interested in the measures of the line, and so that helps me to remember it. To remember it as well.
Yeah.
And if I can get that first line on that, half-hour walk, I can come to the computer and pretty much finish the poem.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Not always in one sitting.
Yeah.
But I can move into the poem and begin to know what to do with that first line.
So I'm curious, Daryl, did your writing of poetry start – when you really got into it with a computer, or did you go Did you ever go pen to paper, pencil to paper?
I still do both.
You do? Okay.
Right, because nearly all of the poems that I write in workshops are written, you know, pen to paper.
Okay, yeah.
But I never really know what a poem is going to look like until I go to the keyboard and see what the poem is going to look like in print.
So, like the layout of it,
yes,
how it looks,
the graphics.
That's a big part of that.
That's right.
Huh. Yeah. And so then that and because I certainly don't know about this, but that will that change certain lines
of
the poem based on how it?
Sure.
Wow.
Sure. Because you know, particularly in this last book, the dominant form of the poem is a sonnet, you know, and even if you take liberties with the metrics of a sonnet, you know, which traditionally in English is written in iambic pentameter, even if you take liberties with that, there are certain things that you can't do. I mean, if you start out with a line that has 8 feet, you know, a hexameter line, you know, you can't go to a 13-foot line, you know, because it ruins. You've made a commitment when you work in a form like the sonnet to a certain amount of formalism, and if you get too informal, you know, you're breaking your own rules. and so you'll notice that you know, in the sonnets, you know, some of the sonnets are skinnier than others, but there's a kind of consistency. If I start with a relatively long line, then the line for the rest of the poem is going to be in these relatively long lines.
Okay, so does it have anything to do ever with then? Though how it – do you read it out loud to yourself or have somebody read it to you? Does that play?
Yes.
Does that have an impact on
– Yes. You know, I do read it out loud to myself to sort of get a sense of the metrics, to get a sense of the kinds of you know, the kind of beat that's being created in the line.
And does sometimes do they not match up with, you know, that you may read it out loud and it sounds fine, but then when you see it printed, it does not look right. Does that happen?
You know, that's when you have to go to the toolbox and find out how much of that line you're going to have to cut.
That would be hard.
It is hard, you know. But if you're committed to the craft, you know, you go in and you cut.
Yeah.
And shave.
Okay. Now, the other thing I'm curious about that. So if you do that, have there been times where initially what was coming to you that poem was about, that then the direction of what the meaning of the poem changed?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And that, you know, that happens with rhyme as well, if you're working in, you know, in a formal pattern. And very often what you thought the poem was going to be about ends up being about something else because of the rhyme. And you also have to be very careful about when you begin a rhymed poem, you know, which sounds you choose.
Yeah.
Because there are certain sounds that just don't work. I mean, you don't have a lot of resources with certain sounds.
Sure.
Right. And so that, you know, that sometimes you get started with a sound that you think is going to work, and then you realize that you painted yourself in a corner.
Yeah.
You know, and that you're going to end up saying, you know, really silly things.
you know, it's interesting because I never thought about that until right at this moment. I never, and maybe it's because I'm more of a audio, you know, what I hear versus what I see. I'm not very visual. I never thought of how the poem looked as playing a role in how the poem ends up.
Yeah. Yes.
That's really interesting.
And you know, for
and you would think that when you think you look at it, but you don't always. I mean, I think the typical person out there, you don't. I don't know. I didn't think about it.
No, I think, and particularly contemporary readers are not readers who are, you know, committed to certain forms. You know, they don't. Many readers don't know what a villanelle is or a sestina or a sonnet and don't care.
Yeah.
And so when – even when they're reading a villanelle, that – the form –
And what is that? I don't know what that is.
A villanelle – Poet Laureate Julie Kane has the best –
Who's very funny, by the way.
Right. Has the best definition of a villanelle. A villanelle repeats certain lines. There's a sort of pattern of repetitions. And she says they are perfect poems for what you feel nervous or angry about. Because when you're nervous or angry, you have a tendency. You know, if you're angry with somebody and you're arguing, you'll keep saying the same thing over and over again. And she says that the villanelle works really well for that kind of poem.
For doing that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you argue in do you argue with Karen in poetry?
No, I don't write villanelles. I have a few sestinas and mostly sonnets.
Yeah.
But one of these days I'd love to play with the villanelle and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, your most recent book that you've put out, Megan's Guitar and Other Poems from Acadie, which actually was put out here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press.
Right.
It's a wonderful book, and I do want to mention, too, since we are on the radio, but you would use some of the artwork from Megan Barra. Oh, it's fabulous.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm a great fan of Megan Barra's work and, you know, have collected her work for years. And the idea for the title poem called Megan's Guitar came out of one of those workshops with kids. And our job was to look at one of Megan's pieces and to write a poem from it. And
nice.
I had this piece, Woman with Guitar, and started the poem.
And that's where it
came
from.
That's where it came
from.
Right.
Well, could you do a reading for us? You have something open. And I'm curious what drew you to that poem that you're going to read.
Before the Sparrows Wakened. There are a couple of three things that drew me to this particular poem. And when I began to think about the book, I knew that this was the opening poem because it is a réveil poem. It's a poem about waking up. There's something else that runs through the book that I think is important in this particular poem, and that's the part that women play in Acadian and Cajun culture. There were incredibly strong women who came with, that first migration of Acadians into Louisiana, and they get lots of poems because Beausoleil, Broussard, Joseph Broussard, is the dominant figure. The three men who led the Acadians, Alexandre Broussard, Joseph Guilbeau, who was called L'Officier, and Joseph Broussard, were important figures, but they were accompanied by these incredible women like Madeleine Trahan and Madeleine and Marguerite Richard Elizabeth Brasseur, who are all really important figures, I think. And in contemporary Cajun culture, the women play such a strong role in shaping character, in shaping the character of the children. And, you know, this isn't just true of Acadian or Cajun culture. That's true in so many cultures. But I knew that I wanted this poem about these women to open the book because of the role that they played. And then what I say from time to time when I'm talking about my experience with getting books published by University of Louisiana Press. When I deliver a manuscript to University of Louisiana Press, they don't question the French in the poems because it's natural to this culture. It might be an affectation in another culture, but it's a natural thing.
Yeah.
And there are some French words, and I wanted in this particular poem to right at the outset, you know, suggest that this is a bilingual culture.
Sure.
And, you know, the kind of little fry bread, you know, which again crosses other cultures that we call les oreilles de cochon, you know, if you call them pig's ears in a poem, they don't mean the same thing as les oreilles de cochon. But to a Cajun child or a Cajun man or woman, les oreilles de cochon means a very specific thing. Yeah. And so, you know, those three things, that it's a wake-up poem, that it's a strong woman poem, and that it has that element of French in it.
So before the sparrows wakened.
Before the sparrows wakened. Before daylight, we were awakened by the voices of my aunts in my mother's kitchen. As soon as my father and my uncles left for work, they appeared like gauzy apparitions and shadowed our back door. The sky outside was but a dimly lighted sheet, and the sparrows were still drowsing lazily in the upper branches of the trees. These birds were rhymes for who we were in our beds, still but being awakened slowly by the voices and the perfume creeping into the woodwork as water plumped the dark, rich grounds in the little blue pot sitting inside another pot on the stove. The anxious thoughts these women carried inside, they put out on the table along with whatever was left from yesterday. Sweet dough pies or fig cakes, gâteau cidre or des oreilles de cochon. On this fair, they would break fast, and whatever gleamed in their lives or in lives close by, they lighted the room with. This hour was something they had taken as theirs, and it was their job to start the day.
You know, when I hear you read that, I had the great fortune to be at a reading that you did for majority retired folks that were volunteers for the Community Action Program in St. Landry Parish. And that poem, as you were just reading again, I could hear, because it was majority women in that room, I could hear their comments.
Yes.
You know, that was interesting for me to hear you read that again and then to relate back to that experience, because, boy, did that resonate with those women.
Yes. Yes. And you know, it's again one of those poems that crosses cultures, because that particular audience was made up primarily of Creole and Black women. And they understood.
And it was
you know, you and I talked about that particular reading, and it was almost like being in church.
It was,
you know,
like being in church.
Right. because they talked back at the poem, and that's you know, that's an incredible experience for a poet. You know, to have people giving a kind of vocal affirmation to what's being said in the poem right there on the spur of the moment. And they recognize that little blue granite coffee pot, you know, which is sometimes white enamel as well. But that little coffee pot sitting inside another pot on the stove, which is so important a part of their morning ritual.
That's right.
As well.
Because, you know, and I remember the last line too about this hour was something they had taken as theirs, and it was their job to start the day. I remember one woman say it again, Daryl.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because that was, and for those women too, I mean, that's.
Yeah.
That's a role they play,
right?
You know,
right,
and continues in in even the younger generations,
right.
You know,
right. And these were all, you know, a group of volunteers. So they were a group of, you know, a group of women who don't have to worry a great deal about what they're going to do with their day.
Yeah,
they wake up. They get started, they do the morning rituals,
That's
and then
right.
they get on with their lives
right.
and do the work that has to be done.
That's right.
What was so incredible to me, Cheryl, was that most of these women were, you know, probably the median age was 80 years old,
mm-hmm.
And they were volunteers who were helping older people
That's right.
than themselves.
And many of them, and a lot of them younger than themselves, yep, said they're helping.
That's right.
Yeah. It was an interesting group.
Right.
Well, I'm going to take Cecil. Okay, we'll come back. I was going to take a short break and play a song, but we'll come back to that. There is Cecil. Can we, since we talked about the awakening, can we put Reveille on and listen to that? You brought in a copy of Zachary's song, Reveille. What meaning does that song have to you?
I think when, you know, Zachary's song has had, a similar effect on lots of people. I knew about the whole, resurgence of interest in Cajun culture and in French language preservation and so forth, but I don't think that I understood it until I heard Zachary sing that song. And I think because there's an urgency in that song,
yeah.
that is also a kind of lyrical urgency, because it's an urgency, but it's an urgency that never leaves the realm of music. I think that's it. I think when you hear that kind of thing, it does something. It shifts something in your soul. I think maybe only one other, maybe two or three other. Singers like I think Nina Simone
mm-hmm.
Has done that to
yeah.
me. There's a kind of wake up and a kind of urgency, in her delivery that's so powerful. Bob Dylan does it, I think Bob Dylan's gift to many of us is that he gave us a new pair of ears,
that's right.
so that we could hear things that we couldn't hear before.
That's right.
And there are, there are other singers. Johnny Cash does it for me too. But Zachary Richard singing that song just opened my ears in a way, that they had not been opened before.
Yeah. Well, let's hear. This is Zachary Richard, Reveille.
Ma famille est mouillée l'Acadie. Elle les maudits rien, nous chasser comme des bêtes, d'être les saintes familles, nous jeter tout souvent. Réveille, réveille, c'est les gardiens qui Boy.
Zachary Richard Rave, if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. Please make sure to check out the website and like us on Facebook. We are a listener-supported radio station, and we appreciate all the help that so many people give us out there in terms of their support to the station, their donations, volunteer work that happens around here. And it is a safe, secure website, so you can help us out online, and that's krvs.org. My guest today, if you're just joining us, is a writer, poet, Daryl Bork. And if that song doesn't go all the way down your spine, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, I mean, Zachary takes you, he just pulls you into, you know, into this incredible world.
That's right.
You know, and it takes a little while to get back.
That's right. Yeah. You know, I'm curious, as I was listening to that, have any of your poems ever been put to music?
No.
Would you ever want to see that happen, or no? You like to keep it separate?
I don't know. It would all depend.
Yeah.
If there was a musician who you know, sort of respected the poem and came to the poem, you know, with the kind of integrity that Zachary always comes to his lyrics and music with, I would love that because there's an audience for song and poetry combined with music that simply isn't there for the poem as poem.
Yeah,
you know, and so that would be that'd be an incredible thing.
Have you ever heard music as you're writing?
No, I haven't because I'm you know, severely challenged musically. and it's one of the great loves of my life. You know, and I can get you know, just as excited listening to Verdi as to Zachary.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, but no, I never hear. You know, it occurred to me when that drum beat came in, you know, that was a way of, you know, Zachary showing, singing that song a cappella first and letting the rhythm of the lines sort of seep into you before it's accompanied with that drum beat.
That's
and
right.
then you really hear it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know what rhythm is.
That's right.
When that comes in. I wish that I did hear more music.
Well, you know, it's because just because you talk, you know, about the rhythm and what you do, there's that rhythm to it. That,
right.
You know, and as you're speaking it, that – yeah, that's what I thought, that there would be sometimes you would maybe hear.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, there's a musical component to the poem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But it, you know, it's not something that I ever hear as song.
Yeah.
You know, it stays poem in my head, at least. And I would, you know, I would be incredibly honored if somebody put it, any of the poems to music.
Yeah. And so with Megan's Guitar, with this latest book that you have put out, some of the poems were already written before the idea of the book came along.
Right.
And then some were written after the idea.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Is the theme that you – there generally would be a theme that you would think of initially. And I'm curious, what how did that process work? Was there a period of time after writing, let's say, four or five poems that, wow, this is going in a direction. Maybe I should think about a book or – Or did the thought of doing a book, and let's see if I have some things that would fit into that.
Well, yeah, there's an interesting little bit of background there. I was commissioned to do a chapbook.
A
chapbook, which is a little book of poems.
Oh, it's called a chap, C-H-A-P?
C-H-A-P.
Oh, okay.
B-O-O-K. It's usually less than 48 pages. That's sort of the mark. 48 pages and more is a full-length manuscript.
Oh, okay.
Anything less is a chapbook. And so I was commissioned by Chicory Bloom Press and Glenn Bacheron from Thibodeau, who works with David Middleton, another well-known Louisiana poet, and he commissioned a chapbook. He said, we want a chapbook of your poems. I wrote 14 poems for that chapbook.
Which, in what kind of time frame are we talking about?
A relatively short time frame, probably 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I said, I'll give you the poems for the chapbook on the condition that I can incorporate them into a larger manuscript.
Huh. Very good.
Okay. And the chapbook was called Holding the Notes. At the time that I was creating the chapbook, I was also really involved with my mother and caretaking of her. And So the Holding the Notes is a poem about her beginning to sing as she was dying. And so there's that kind of theme of strong women, and resilient women, and the power of song, and how song often takes us out.
Yeah, that's right.
As we're leaving, it's often one of the last things that we sort of hold on to, and how it shapes culture and so forth. And so those ideas, the idea of song shaping culture enriching culture was an idea that was prevalent in the chapbook. And the idea of strong women was prevalent in the chapbook.
Yeah.
And then we got involved, Zachary Richard and Barry Ancelet and Marius Schmoly and I got involved in a project where Marius wanted to produce a musical theater work on the Acadians. And so Zachary and I began to have conversations about this musical work. And Zachary is all over this book. From beginning to end. Zachary actually projected a two-act, 16-scene drama about Beausoleil, and even wrote some of the music and some of the songs for it. The project sort of fell apart in the fundraising phase of it. And yet I had all of these conversations that Zachary and I had been having, and he was feeding me history all of the time because my job was going to be to write the libretto for the opera. And so he was feeding me this history, and I had this information. And when it was clear that there was not going to be a musical production as we had imagined it, I began to take this material and turn it into the second half of the book. The first half of the book, I think the nucleus for the first half of the book is Holding the Notes, a sort of elegy for my mother.
Yeah.
And then the second half came out of that project. Sometime well into the project, Barry and I began to talk about what we were doing, and he would say, "Well, why don't you write a poem about Madeleine Trahan?" And I'd say, "I don't know Madeleine Trahan, but if you give me three sentences and a little bit of history, I'll try."
Yeah.
And so that's how some of the poems were shaped.
Huh.
You know, I remember meeting David Greeley in Grand Coteau. We happened to both be in the kitchen shop at Grand Coteau at the same time. And I was, he said, you know, like, what you been doing? And I talked to him about the book that was in the process of being made. And he said, well, you know, why don't you write a poem about my grandfather, Olivier Thériault, who I didn't know at the time. Yeah. And what was so wonderful about this book was that it was one revelation after another, you know, because Thériault, Olivier Thériault, is responsible for bringing the second largest migration of Acadians into the Louisiana territory. And they were Acadians who had been exiled to France.
And that was his grandfather, great.
It was maybe great, great,
several
grandfathers back.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was three when they were deported from Canada and went to the you know, the Brittany region of France, and were settled on. Here were a group of farmers who were settled on soil that couldn't be farmed.
Sure,
you know, and so they were constantly. Thinking about, you know, what about their future and how difficult it was going to be. And then when the Spanish government, the controlling government for the Louisiana Territory was Spain, and they were trying to populate the territory. And so they, a man who was married to an Acadian living in New Orleans, contacted Thériault in France. He got seven shiploads of Acadians who had been exiled to France to come to New Orleans. And when they got here, they eventually settled that area from Donaldsonville on south to the Gulf in the Bayou LaFourche area, or what was – before it was called Bayou LaFourche, it was the river of the Chittimacha.
Yeah.
You know, that's how that poem got made, and it was typical of how much of the second part of the book got made. Was the formula was my discovering a piece of history and then turning it into a poem. Right.
Can you read us another piece that might maybe have – do you have one that – for what you've just been talking about that would relate to that?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, too, is, you know, you were talking about the history with that. You know, we get so used to how we travel now. It's really hard to understand what that was like, you know, just in terms of the ship and the kind of ships and what those, you know, it's not like people going on a cruise today,
right,
you know,
right.
That it's just it's hard to comprehend what that was like.
Right, right. You know? And you know, when the Halifax Acadians, the 1765 Acadians who settled into that area around Lake Fosse Point and St. Martinville in New Iberia, when they came into the territory, their original plan, according to some stories, was to go back up the Mississippi and to go into what is now the Chicago area because there was a French and Native American settlement there. And there were several things that happened. One was, you know, some kind of widespread disease that killed over 30% of the population.
Yeah.
And so that slowed them down. But there were other factors as well.
You know, it's interesting because I grew up on the Mississippi River, but in Wisconsin, right on the Wisconsin-Minnesota border. And when we were home visiting, I remember shortly after I'd first moved here, we counted and pulled out the phone book, and there were 15 similar family names. As there are down, you know, and I was like, oh, like I grew up with Comos and Lafleurs, and now we had Thibodeaux, but it was Thibodeau, you know,
right.
It wasn't pronounced, but we had Boudreaux. I mean, and it was really, and there was a lot of French missionaries that came down the Mississippi.
Sure.
But I, you know, I was always curious after moving here that, you know, I never thought about it when I grew up there.
Yeah.
But after living here, it's like, how did a lot of those families and some of those families, did they come from?
Yeah.
From that area versus coming from France, you know?
And, you know, it's not unusual to find communities of Native Americans, French and French people together.
Exactly.
And I'm sure they were, you know, that's true.
And the town is called La Crosse, which is an Indian name.
Right.
It's a Native American name.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it was quite a mix there.
Yeah. Chicago is a Native American.
That's right.
It means wild onion.
Wild onion.
Yeah. This is Olivier Thériault at the headwaters of Bayou Lafourche. If I had known what I know now, I would have probably called it Olivier Thériault at the headwaters of the River of the Chittimachas, because for a lot of reasons.
And
here's the poem, the sonnet. I was but four when they began to move us out of our new world, to herd us like cattle with no say about where we might want to live. Little clots of memory held me to this time. Blue water, a sway in names of places we were connected to, Rivière de Moulin aussi, on Île Saint-Jean, Rivière au Canard near Grand Pré, Saint-Malo in Brittany, and the Reims estuary. I took to study of sin and grace when I was still a boy and learned how the day-to-day makes us what we are. In Nantes, I made shoes at first for kin and then for everyone in the town. I married the woman I'd lay my life down for. When I met Peru, I had little doubt his plan would deliver us all. On La Bergère, I made my way into Acadie Tropicale. But like so much before, fruit would rot, not ripen. Then the waters forked into wild land and open bays. What happened to the group from Canada when they got here, and interestingly, La Bergère came to Louisiana on August the 15th, which is now the National Day of the Acadians. When they got here, Pedro said to Olivier Thériault, I promised you nothing. And so he had seven shiploads of Acadians who had crossed the Atlantic that he had to settle. And he had no resources.
Nothing.
With nothing.
Yeah.
With absolutely nothing. Nothing but the land that forked into wild bays and open lands. And so the land saved them over and over again.
And still does for a lot of people.
Right.
You know?
Right. Exactly. You know, these... You know, many of these were the Cajuns who became the sort of archetypal trappers and fishermen, because that region sort of reshaped them. Here were a whole population of people who had only known farming, and then the land sort of redefined them in an interesting kind of way.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, the thought just occurred to me, separate from all this, but poetry, what a wonderful form for teaching history, you know?
Right. And that, Cheryl, was one of my objectives in writing this book of poems, because I wanted it to be historical, but I wanted the figures to be humanized.
Yeah.
Because I think part of it has to do with the ways in which we're caricatured, in popular culture. I don't know. Well, I know a few people who look like the people on Duck Dynasty.
Yeah, that's right. But,
but more of the people that I know, in this culture look like me and you.
Sure.
And not the people on Swamp People.
Yeah.
We're caricatured. Our food is altered in a way. I had a gumbo recently in Naperville, Illinois, that I almost couldn't eat.
Yeah.
There's only so much that you can do to shrimp, and shrimp will often save a dish.
Sure, yeah.
That a bad cook has almost destroyed.
Yeah.
That was the thing that I wanted to happen in this book.
Yeah.
That the history would remain true.
Yeah.
you know. And there are all kinds of variables here. You know, we don't know exactly what the history is, because when you're trying to erase a people, you don't document it.
No. And, you know, it's interesting you bring that. You know, I'd had a shop for years, and this was probably a good 10 years ago now, that I always remember these two women came in and said that they wanted to go see some of those Cajuns, is how they put it. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, you know, they're those Cajuns that live in those shacks, or they just live on the water and they live – and what they started describing. I said, well, look, you know, you were just talking to my mailman who walked out here. He is.
Yes.
And, you know, then we had that conversation. And it's kind of sad for me, because the way – what they were looking for, it wasn't necessarily how they were describing it, a positive thing. It wasn't looking for – I always think like of Greg Girard, somebody who really has learned about the land and living off the land, you know, but it was more that caricature. And so then all these years go by, and now it's like now, because of it's back again with the reality shows.
Right. Right.
You know?
Right.
And I remember it was sad for me that day, just how they.
They would be so disappointed if they met Greg Girard, you know, and they'd have to talk to a philosopher.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, that's so true.
Right.
That's so true.
Right.
Can I have you read, because we are getting short on time, can I have you read Church Point Breakdown?
Yeah.
Can we
sure.
do that? And
sure.
We'll just talk, and then we're going to be heading out here.
All right. Church Point Breakdown. Before you could walk, someone or another crossed a leg and put you on a foot, gave you your first ride, singing Tigalo, Tigalo. It was your first lesson in mobility. It was your first dance. In the playground or under the oak, you sang Sot Krapo with your cousins. You were learning double entendre along with resilience and rejuvenation, an early lesson in transformational syntax. Mostly in the morning, you sang Frère Jaco to be awake, a call in rounds to mindfulness, to get on with your life, not to sleep your life away. And then came the other songs, Bonsoir Moreau and J'ai passé, La porte en arrière, Viens me chercher, and Les flammes d'enfer. Everything comes to us through the body, the great metered muscle met et maîtresse, showing us how to sing, sex and love, loneliness and desire, how to fall apart, how to hold things together, when to stay, when to let go.
And it's a very nice, you know, it for me now that is the maybe the fourth time I've heard you read that. And it was one of the first times that I had the realization of listening to it as I would a song. Like, you read that one again. You know how you would like a song. Play that song again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very, very nice.
Yeah.
I do want to mention, too, your involvement with the Louisiana Poetry Project and also Festival of Words. Two really great projects and organizations that you've been connected to.
Yeah. You know, the Louisiana Poetry Project.org, I think, is the URL for it, is a wonderful program run by Laurie Williams out of New Orleans. And any teacher looking for, easily teachable ways to bring poetry into the classroom, that's a good thing. The mission of Festival of Words is to bring literature and literacy initiatives to the rural communities in Acadiana. And that's something that we're deeply committed to. Two of the projects that I've just taken on are the New Acadia Project, which is a project with a steering committee that's made up of many leaders in the area, including Warren and Mary Perrin and Dr. Mark Reese here at University of Louisiana. And the objective is to find the locations of those first camps, or those first homesteads of the Acadians. And my latest project is a story exchange project. I'm one of the founding members of Narrative 4 out of Chicago, which is a program to bring story exchange to traumatized areas of the world.
Very nice.
And one of my objectives, when people think of the places they need to go to do these projects, they think of the big cities.
Yeah.
They think of Haifa and Tel Aviv in the Middle East. And, you know, they think that New Orleans is Louisiana,
yeah.
You know, and I want to, again, introduce that idea of the rural community and how needy, you know, how much the rural community needs these kinds of programs. And so, you know, that's my mission in
nice.
Narrative 4.
Yeah. Well, I do know that you have, and there may be some readings before, but I do know you have a reading coming up. September 21st at the Washington Garden Club.
Right.
At the Old Episcopal Church there in Washington.
Right.
Do you have others?
I am going to read Saturday in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Oh,
so
very
if
nice.
Anybody in the audience is picking this up in Jackson or Vicksburg, come to meet us there at Lorelei Books.
Very nice.
And one of the readings that I'm really looking forward to is a reading in Charrington on the Saturday before Thanksgiving at the Chittimacha Museum.
Very good.
And we're working on a reading in the New Iberia area as well. Yeah.
Well, it's Cecil, how about if we go out on Church Point Breakdown, huh? It's been a pleasure having you on here today.
Thank you so much.
I really, really appreciate it. And Megan's Guitar and Other Poems from Aka D, Daryl Bork. Have a good week, everyone. Bye.